welcome to another episode. More Colts, please.
Is there...
Saqib, Anik, and Anwar.
Yep.
We're about to talk about the most controversial issue of our generation.
What's that?
It's not what you think it is. It's about Islamic dietary laws. What is halal and what is zabiha? Do they even matter? So, Anik, what school of thought do you follow?
So, background, I did zabiha only until I was like 18 or so. Then went non-zabiha, and I'm still in that school of thought, non-zabiha.
Anwar, what school of thought do you follow?
I ate non-zabiha my entire life until I was probably 21 or so, and then I started eating only zabiha meat.
So for me, up until I was 17, I didn't even know that I had a choice, or I didn't even know that there was
in the same boat.
I didn't even know that there was another way of looking at it. So I ate only zabiha, and even then, I followed the tradition of asking people, is this zabiha or is this halal? Just another layer of confirmation. And then when I moved to, so that was in Houston, and then when I moved to San Antonio, I started meeting people at the masjid who would go to McDonald's,
yeah.
who would go to Burger King and stuff, and I'd be like, well, what's wrong with you guys? Why aren't
you getting a fish fillet?
Why aren't you getting a fish fillet? And they'd be like, just say bismillah. And I was like, what? Don't you say bismillah anyway? So,
and for the non-Muslims at home, you want to explain what zabiha is?
So let's get into a little background. Anwar, you back me up if I'm mischaracterizing something. So the term halal basically means permissible, or in modern sense, it would mean something that's legal, that's allowed within the boundaries of what's allowed versus not allowed in the religion sense, in the religious sense.
Yeah.
But not in the legal sense, like in courts of laws or something like that.
Right. This is more of a personal practice type thing,
right,
like in your daily life.
So zabiha is the actual set of dietary conditions that have to be performed on the meat before it's killed, on the animal before it's killed.
Similar to kosher,
that put it in the category of halal. Is that right?
Well, that's where the difference of opinion is.
Right. Okay. No, but I mean, the gist of what I'm saying is right. Right. That's what zabiha. But what are those conditions?
Right.
That's where the issue is.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
All
right.
So Anik and I follow similar schools of thought. Anwar follows something different.
The wrong school of thought.
Okay. That's what we believe, right?
Just kidding, Anwar.
Where do you think the majority of the, and this is strictly like an American and European Muslim issue.
Right. Well, and if you're in a majority Muslim country, it's not really, it's a non-issue because everybody's Muslims and you assume that it's all zabiha.
And you don't have to worry about pork. You don't have to ask. It's just, you just know.
And this is relatively recent, right? I mean, 15, 20 years ago, there wasn't really this discussion. Now there is a discussion. Is it zabiha? Is it not zabiha? Should it be zabiha? Should it not be zabiha?
I think there was 15, 20 years ago.
I think
you guys, you were raised eating zabiha, but there were a lot of people that... You know, I think what it is.
But was it a religious justification, or was it just like, I mean, the same people that they don't pray, they don't do anything else?
No, that's not true at all.
Was it an actual religious?
Yeah, there was a religious opinion. So that's what we'll get into, I guess.
Yeah.
Is different religious opinions. So a lot of them are sort of regional. So within Islam, there's like different schools of thought, and these schools of thought have their own little scholar. They're groups of scholars, you know, that derive opinions from, you know, ancient scholars, you know.
Can you just give some background? What is the point of a school of thought?
The point of it?
Or what is a school of thought, and then what do you think is the point of it? Like, why
do
we have them?
So, back in the day, like maybe in the first couple hundred years of Islamic history, there were certain scholars that were very, very well known, very renowned, and very respected, and they came to a body of opinions on different issues. And so people have sort of named schools of thought after those scholars. You know, scholars who have similar opinions and use the same types of rules and everything to derive opinions as those scholars, that becomes a school of thought. And there, I mean, my understanding is there used to be like a whole bunch of them, but a lot of them were lost throughout history as we lost, you know, like when the Mongols came and destroyed like half of Islamic literature and stuff like that. So we don't know about a lot of the schools of thought that used to exist.
Yeah.
There are four, or for the Shias, there are five main schools of thought, I guess I should say, just to be very inclusive. So it's like, and they're named after scholars. So Imam Abu Hanifa, Hanbal.
So that's the Hanafi school of thought?
That's the Hanafi
school. Which is prominent in South Asia.
Yeah. In the subcontinent, it's very prominent. And I think also in like East Asia, like in Indonesia and Malaysia, I think those are prominent there as well. Then there's like Hanbali, Maliki.
For Ahmad ibn Hanbal?
Yeah.
And Maliki, Ahmad.
Something like that. some
Ibn Malik.
Great respected scholar named Malik. and then there was Shafi.
Mm-hmm.
And then Jafari is the other one that's like...
So there's actually six.
Oh, there's another one
there's
too?
There's a Zaydi school of thought also in Shias.
So I wasn't aware of that one.
Yeah, so that's... Those are the two main schools of thought within Shias.
Okay.
So as far as you know, are there differences of opinion in terms of dietary laws between these? Because from what I've read, there's basically two or two and a half camps that encompass all of these.
Yeah, as far as this issue is concerned, yeah, there's pretty much two main camps.
So what's the point of these schools of thought? Like, why they obviously teach something different. How did they come to different conclusions on similar issues?
So a lot of people would tell you that it's because some of them didn't have access to all of the hadith at the time. Some of them would tell you that they just had different ways of they gave importance to different practices. Like some people might look at, some of the scholars might have looked at, rather than textual, like a hadith, like a saying of the Prophet himself, they might give precedence to like the common practice of the people of, say, Medina at the time, or the prominent practice of certain Sahaba, certain companions of the Prophet. So that's kind of where the different schools differ, is, you know, either they didn't have access to the same information, or they just gave priority to different sources.
But there were schools of thought that were kind of formulating, or I guess I should say codifying their practices around the same time as each other.
Yeah, they all were around the same time, within the few couple centuries at least.
So was it like regional differences when you say they didn't have access to, you know, sayings?
I don't think there were so much regional differences at the time. I mean, I don't think Imam Abu Hanifa probably was not in Pakistan or India. I'm not really sure where he lived, but I'm sure it was like, it was like Damascus or something like that, you know. But I don't. Well, actually, I think there are a lot of Jordanians that are considered themselves Hanafi. But no, I don't think it was regional at the time. But I think it sort of developed into a regional thing later on. That certain areas follow different schools of thought.
Okay. So, as far as you know, what is the history of this term Zabiha? Because it's not in the Quran. And as far as I could find, the Prophet never used this term.
Yeah. Honestly, I don't know the exact translation of the word Zabiha. But I think it means like slaughtering an animal, but I'm not 100% sure what the actual word means in Arabic. Do you guys know?
I don't know the origins of the actual word. I just know that this was a term derived by scholars within the coming centuries after the Prophet. So the point from what I can gather of these different schools of thought is for legal purposes. So for example, after the Prophet, we had the Sahaba, the companions of the Prophet, the ones who knew the Prophet, who bled with the Prophet, who died, you know, around the same time as the Prophet, or some exceeded his life. When they were asked questions, they knew the answer because they knew the Prophet. So their answer, in effect, was, what would the Prophet do in this time? So that was their answer, what they thought the Prophet would do. And so their students, the Tabi'in, who were the next in authority, when they were asked a question that the Prophet didn't answer in his time, their answer was what they thought that the Prophet would do.
Yeah.
And so there started
this
being...
This is called ijtihad.
Right, right.
The process of answering a question that wasn't answered by the Prophet himself.
So
his time.
People, this term is actually a controversial term in today's time because people have taken liberties with that term to think it just means that you can interpret it your way and just come up with your own logical answer.
Right.
And not basing it on the Sunnah of the Prophet.
Right.
Which is, so you'll have people like Irshad Manji, who, do you know who she is?
No.
She's a journalist based in Toronto who writes about Muslim issues, but she's kind of taken liberties and appointed herself as an authority on these matters.
As a mujtahid,
while delegitimizing actual scholars.
Okay.
And she has a following because she was on the New York Times bestseller list.
Yeah.
But she's, I mean, with all due respect, like, she's full of shit.
Yeah.
I mean... Like I've
hard to give any respect when you say shit. Okay.
No.
With all due, whatever that amount
is.
Whatever's due.
I only say that about someone who, you know, when you see them on TV and they're making a point, but they're not backing it up. It's their own opinion versus citing someone who's actually done the research.
Right.
You know, so like I won't say anything. If I give an opinion, it's not going to be my opinion, or it'll be my opinion, but based on someone who knows more than me, like a scholarly opinion.
Right.
And just a quick side note, you're asking the definition. I just looked it up. According to ISAHalal.org, Zabiha is just a specific word that means slaughtered. It's derived from the Arabic word tabi, which means slaughter. In some cultures, it's called zabih.
So slaughtered.
Okay. So we're digressing too much, right? So thank you for bringing
good stuff.
Yeah, thank you for bringing it back.
Yeah.
So now the question is, what is considered within the bounds of Zabiha?
Zabiha halal.
Actually, I don't know if that's the question. The question is, I think, does it have to be Zabiha to be halal?
Okay. That's a good question.
So I don't think there's a difference of opinion on what Zabiha is. I think the difference of opinion is, it comes in mostly in Muslim, non-Muslim countries where there are Ahl al-Kitab or people of the book, where they are the majority in that country. For example, America, where Christians are the majority. Because the Quran says that the food of the people of the book is halal or permissible for you, and your food is permissible for them, certain schools of thought take the opinion that, you know, the food of the people of the book or the Christians here in America is halal. So it doesn't mean that it's necessarily zabiha, but it is permissible anyway.
Okay. You know, it's funny you bring that up. I don't even think most people know of this verse in the Quran, in Surah Maida. I don't even think, like, I've had discussions with people where I bring this verse. It blows their mind.
You mean Muslims?
Muslims.
Oh, really?
I bring this verse to them, and they never thought about it. And I've had some people tell me that non-zabiha food is more haram. I don't even know if that even makes sense. More haram than pork.
Well, come on. The Quran is pretty clear about pork, like, straight up.
Yeah.
There's no argument.
There's zero wiggle room for that.
What's
the verse from Surah Maida that you're talking about?
I mean, we're paraphrasing, but it's basically exactly what Anwar said.
The general gist of it is, and this is way, way paraphrasing and definitely not a direct quote, but the meaning essentially is, yeah, that the food of the people of the book is permissible for you, and your food is permissible for them. And the people of the book being Jews and Christians, essentially.
Right, so let me ask you, Anwar, is that not enough for you to eat, you know, from...
And just to give the exact verse, because I think I have it here. Are you talking about the one that says, "Today all good food is made lawful for you. The food of the people of the scripture, Jews and Christians, is lawful, halal for you." Like, is that the gist of it? Okay.
Yeah. So that's the ayah we're talking about. So for me, in America, or anywhere, the food of the people of the book, I accept that ayah, of course. I will eat the food of the people of the book. But to me... Just like food at some random restaurant in America is not the food of the people of the book. That's the opinion that I take. I don't think it qualifies. Now, there is kosher. There are things that are labor... There are actual kosher restaurants. There are kosher products that you can buy. Those are obviously food of Jews. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's labeled kosher, so it's very clearly Jewish food.
What about Christian food? Like, what do you consider Christian food?
I don't think there is anything such as Christian food in the world right now. And I've asked Christians this, and they've told me the same. They're like, do you guys have, like, Christian food?
Mm-hmm.
They're like, no.
Okay, so I also did whatever research is out there on that. So their way of making their food permissible for them is that they bless it before they eat it. That's the only, like that's it. They either don't do anything... And they're okay with that, but if they follow their, like, the practice of their preachers and their scholars before them, is that it's either kosher. If it's not kosher, then they'll bless the food before eating it.
So they're okay with kosher as well. That they consider that's already been blessed.
Right. But for so it's like these lines that, you know, if it doesn't pass this one, then do this. If it doesn't pass that, then do this. And the last thing that makes it okay for them is that they bless the food.
And that's the argument for the non-Zabiha camp.
They say that
you should just bless it, say God's name before
say
you
Bismillah.
Eat the food.
Yeah.
Say Bismillah before you eat the food.
So similar to ours, that are the opinion of a lot of people, a lot of Muslims.
Yeah. So let me ask you this. Would you consider Chick-fil-A to be Christian food?
No.
Why not? I mean, it's clearly a Christian organization.
Do they bless
it? I don't know, but I mean they have the suit of a Christian organization. I mean,
so if a Christian person, like, are you telling me that the majority of Christians are blessing their food before they eat it?
I don't know.
Do you think that's the case, based on your experience
before,
of Christians in this country? We've all lived here, born and raised.
Okay,
so
have you ever
seen a Christian bless the food aside from saying a prayer before they start?
Well, I think that's what it means.
Yeah,
but I don't think Christians have ever had a way of slaughtering their meat or whatever.
Well, he's saying that they do a blessing.
So slaughtering the meat is not it's not like the last line of making the food legal for them. The last line for them is to bless the food before they eat it, which is in essence saying a prayer before they eat
it. Right, and the Quran doesn't say the food of the people of the book, Christians and Jews, is acceptable, assuming it's kosher, assuming that the Christians did it a certain way. It just says that the food of the people
So a verse like that is somewhat vague, right? Because we know that there are other verses that are general in essence, but then scholars later on have kind of put these conditions in place that make that statement permissible, or that make it acceptable. I mean, examples don't come to mind, but you understand what I'm talking about, right? Like, just because it says it doesn't mean there are certain conditions in place that make the phrase applicable. So when I looked at scholarly opinions, so there are the ones that follow your opinion that say either they do it their traditional way where they bless the meat before, otherwise it's haram. But then there's some like Yusuf Qaradawi, who's actually alive today. He's the senior scholar at Al-Azhar in Egypt. His opinion kind of, I feel like it's valid for today's multicultural time. He says, basically, okay, if you can get that food where they say Bismillah, you know, before the end of the halal food, that's good. This ayah in the Quran, this surah, where Allah says that the food of the people of the book is permissible to you, that's also good. If you feel that their food is not, like, it's not Christian food, it's just something, it's not blessed in any way.
It's secular food.
Right,
it's
if it's secular
food,
then say Bismillah on it. Okay. If you're not comfortable with that, if that's not enough for you, but you still believe in that ayah where it says that the food of the people of the book is still good for you, then find out what they consider permissible. And if it's permissible for them, then it's permissible for you.
I would say that's fair.
Do you take issue with that?
I mean, that's not good enough for me. Because they consider everything permissible.
No. Well,
I mean, I've never met a Christian who said, like, my religion doesn't allow me to eat this. Except for some sects might not eat certain things.
No, so there are some things that we know that there are certain rules in Christianity, but they don't follow it. You know, like they're not allowed to eat shellfish, they're not allowed to eat pork.
I mean, I don't know if I've ever met a Christian that doesn't eat pork.
Let me make some quick.
I know they exist. I know they exist. I'm not saying they don't exist, but what I'm saying is the vast majority.
Yeah, no. I mean, whether the vast majority...
So if the vast majority are not even following anything in their religion, so then how is
that doesn't invalidate
to me it does. I mean,
if no one follows it,
yeah, like what's the difference between their food and any other food? Then is there any difference?
No, in terms of what they allow themselves to consume,
like if they allow themselves to eat everything, right,
unless the Quran or
right, so like
specifically prohibits
right, so like it prohibits pork, right, so we can't, obviously we can't eat pork, but like you're eating it because it's the food of the Christians, but the Christians have like a lot of the Christians, the majority I would say, have no dietary restrictions whatsoever. So how do you differentiate between Christian food and any other food?
No. What I'm saying is that just because they don't follow a rule doesn't invalidate the rule. Like the rule does exist. Those guidelines do exist.
So you would only eat Christian food that's according to like the Bible guidelines.
No. So that's how Jews follow, right? The Old Testament, they follow those rules. Then we have the Gospel, in which scholars after the gospel was codified had their own rules, similar to the way we had our scholars codify rules and be more specific about what they mean. So Christians, their last line of legality is to bless the food, which is very similar to how we bless the food.
But that's, see, I don't think it's that clear. Like, there are a lot of different types of Christians. And I accept them all as Christians. I mean, I'm not saying that, but I'm sure they all have a different... I mean, a lot of them probably don't have that rule that it has to be blessed or anything like that.
Let me ask you this, Omar. So I'll concede that point, okay? Like, let's say that you can define Christian food, whatever, etc. But that's just like a small portion of it. So, I mean, would you agree that like the Quran specifically says that unless it's specifically forbidden, that it's okay for you to eat?
Yeah, I agree.
Okay. So what makes you feel that the Quran specifically prohibits?
Because the Quran says that you cannot eat meat on which the name of Allah has not been said.
Right, but when does the name of Allah need to be said?
I think it's pretty clear. There's an ayah. I don't remember the ayah.
That's
but
what I
want to
get to. Yeah, I have
that
it
talks
here.
About how
yeah.
when they are lined up, you
exactly.
say the name of Allah on them, and you slaughter.
I have
them.
It here. I'll look it up for you. But essentially, there's a surah, and it's actually about Hajj. I think it's called Hajj.
Surah Hajj.
And one of the ayahs in there, if I find it, I'll read it off. But essentially, it says while the animals are lined up, that you should say the name of Allah. It never specifies when or right before you slaughter it. It doesn't even like specify the slaughter. Like there's no, you know, time delineation between the two. It says the animals' offerings are among the rites decreed by God for your own good. You shall mention God's name on them while they are sawaf. Then once they are offered for sacrifice, you shall eat therefrom and feed the poor and needy. This is why we should do them for you, etc., etc. So sawaf, the definition of sawaf according to this is standing in line. So in my opinion, and we've had this discussion offline all the time as well, the Quran has plenty of examples of when you should say Bismillah before eating the animal. This is really the only example referring to while they're standing in line. But it's in Surah Hajj.
Actually, I don't think that's true. I don't
okay.
think the Quran talks about saying Bismillah before you eat anything anywhere.
I think there are. There's. I mean, I'll find
I
a
mean,
more.
I
don't
I
think there's
heard,
a single ayah that says
that.
No.
I think he's talking about in
no.
like the general sense of before you do something, say Bismillah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Honestly,
well,
I don't even think that's in the Quran, actually.
I'm pretty
but.
Sure it is. I'll try to find a verse for you here. But there's plenty of examples, I think, that I found while looking at it where you should say Bismillah before eating any type of food, not necessarily meat. But if you eat fruit,
that's
if you eat vegetables,
well,
I'm
let,
like
let,
99%
we'll,
sure
we'll
that's
let him finish his point.
Okay.
But go ahead and finish
well,
his point.
Well, let's concede that. So the surah is Hajj. In that same surah, it gives five other examples of when you should say Bismillah, right? And the kind of theme of the surah is that you should constantly say Allah's name, be appreciative, and say His name. So you can't necessarily take that in that one specific example and then just expand it to it's something that we need to do all the time. And also, it specifically says sawaf while they're standing in line. It never says before they're slaughtered. It never gives any other. It just says while they're standing in line, you should say Allah's name.
Right. So, first of all, I'm pretty sure that's the only time it ever mentions saying the name of Allah on something. That, and also when the other time it says, don't eat of meat that on which the name of Allah has not been pronounced.
Actually think that's a slightly misquote, and there's an important distinction to be made.
Okay.
I don't think the Quran says that where Allah's name has not been invoked. It says where any god other than Allah. Or sorry, a name.
No, there are two verses. One says
okay.
any other than Allah, and the other one says on which the name is not been pronounced. You're right about that. There is one verse that says, do not eat of meat on which any other name has been pronounced. And there's another one that says, do not eat of meat on which Allah's name has not been pronounced.
Okay.
So those are both ayat.
Okay.
There are, as far as I know, unless you can find a verse, I don't remember ever reading a verse where it says that you should say Bismillah before you eat food.
I mean, it just seems like, even if it's not in the Quran, it just seems like a general practice.
It is something. No, I'm not
done.
Saying it's not in Islam. That's one thing is, like, we're just looking at the Quran. There's a whole body of knowledge that we're completely ignoring, which is the Hadith. That's something that these scholars that we're talking about, these mujtahids, they use the Hadith to come to these opinions as well. Like, our deen, our religion is not Quran. It's Quran and Sunnah.
Yeah.
It's both.
Okay, so
we have
so,
to use
so
the life
me,
of the Prophet Muhammad to interpret the Quran.
So let me ask you this then. Based on your understanding...
Just a quick, the verse that I found.
Okay.
So the explanation of this by this website is God has also specified a very important criteria for his true believers with regards to food. And then it's Surah 5 verse 4 and Surah 6 verses 118-119. It says, you shall eat from them upon which God's name has been pronounced if you truly believe in his revelation. So... You're
talking about meat, right?
No, just it doesn't specify meat. Just,
what does them eat from them? Who is them?
Like food.
Any food?
You shall eat from them that upon which God's name has been pronounced if you truly believe in his revelation.
And what's the tafsir of that ayah?
And then it farther goes on saying, why should you not eat from that upon which God's name has been mentioned? He has detailed for you what is prohibited for you unless you're forced, etc., etc. So basically saying, unless it's prohibited... Why should you not eat it, and you should say God's name on it?
So let me give you another example of why this is, honestly, this is the way we're approaching coming to the opinion. Like you said earlier, when we say what our opinions are, we don't base it on what our opinion is.
Mm-hmm.
We base it on the opinion of legitimate scholars who are much more qualified than us. Like, I might be qualified as a dentist. I'm not really qualified as an Islamic scholar. So I have to defer to...
I don't even know what kind of dentist you are, dude. I came in for root canal and you gave me... I don't know what you did to my
I don't even touch root canal. We have to defer to scholars who know, honestly, what the hell they're talking about. You know what I mean? And we don't. I don't. I mean, I can speak for myself.
But there's plenty of scholars
out
there.
And I have never said that there's not a legitimate opinion, that you guys are not following a legitimate opinion.
Yep.
I've never said that. And I will say right now that you guys are following a legitimate opinion. But there is another legitimate opinion,
right,
which is my opinion.
Right.
The only
thing that I would say is I agree. I mean, you have your own opinion. Everyone has their own opinion. That's fine. But the thing for me where I kind of get hesitant a little bit is, I mean, the Quran specifically, and there's a verse here somewhere I can pull up, but the synopsis of it is, if it's not specifically declared as haram, that it is an extreme, not sin, but it's really bad to say something is unlawful unless it's specifically... So for me, I'm erring on the side of, I'm going to keep saying it's unlawful until I see something definitive, concrete, that clearly says...
You mean you're going to... Considered lawful.
Yeah, right. So I'm going to consider eating nanzabiya lawful until I see a verse or something that clearly, without a doubt, says it's haram.
Right.
And then I'll be okay with saying it's haram.
Have you ever read any scholarly... I mean, like, have you ever read, like, Abu Hanifa's opinion on it?
I don't know if it was Abu Hanifa, but yeah, I mean, when I set it up on the website and stuff, I did research a bunch of different things.
Because they have legitimate reasons why they say that, and that's what I'm kind of deferring back to, is that... They're legitimate scholars. They are not going to say something is haram. I mean, they know that better than you, that the ayah says that everything is halal unless it's specifically forbidden.
Mm-hmm.
Let me go back to what I was going to say
yeah.
earlier, why it's dangerous to just sit here and cherry-pick ayahs from the Qur'an and,
mm-hmm.
and interpret them ourselves, reading them in a language that it wasn't even written in, reading somebody else's tafsir. There's a verse in the Qur'an that says, do not take the Jews and Christians as awliya over yourselves. Awliya, I'm saying for the benefit of actually knowing what it actually says, so I don't misinterpret it right here. But what it translated to in the translation that I was reading at the time was that do not take them as friends. It said don't take them as friends. So I took that verse and I literally like told my non-Muslim friends that, dude, I don't know, man. Like, I'm reading the Quran and it says I can't even be like, I literally told them I can't be friends with you because of my stupid misunderstanding of this ayah that I was reading in English. It wasn't even written in English. And I had no understanding what the context of that ayah was, or, you know, any of hadith related to this ayah, or any story behind it, nothing. I'm just reading words in English, and I interpreted them wrong.
Right.
And I thought that you could, and there's absolutely nothing wrong being friends with non-Muslims.
Right.
And
that's debatable, though, right? I mean, I think it's across the board, maybe you can correct me, but it's not debatable. It's understood that the Quran says what's haram is clearly explained as haram. And to call something haram that is not haram is not something that we should be doing at all.
But,
I mean, that part, the basis of it, is agreed across the board, right?
Right, and there are a plethora of scholars who have devoted their entire lives for centuries and centuries to studying Islam who have come to the opinion that it is haram.
Yeah.
So, like, you're going to negate all, like, you think that's just something to, you know, they're probably wrong. Like, okay. You know what I mean? Like, they also knew about the ayah that you're talking about.
I agree. Let me sidetrack for 1 second just to make a point here. So you're saying that these guys have studied it forever and they know more about it than we do, so we should maybe defer to that. Let me give you a similar example, which I think that we agree on.
But the thing is, on your opinion, you're also doing the same thing. That's all. That's what I'm pointing out. You are also deferring to scholars, and that's why I say that your opinion is also legitimate, because those people had legitimate opinions and my people had legitimate opinions. That's all it is. They're both, I mean, I can't, I'm not here to convince anybody
that my opinion is the right opinion.
But for me, I consider it more valid.
What I don't get is that, okay, so when we say something is haram, we're saying that it's a sin that's punishable in the afterlife. Okay, so do you think that this act that we do is punishable in the afterlife? Knowing that there are legitimate scholars that say it's not.
It's not for you. It's not.
Why?
When you follow the opinion of a legitimate scholar, it's not a sin.
Gotcha. Because if it ends up being wrong, it's not our fault.
It's not your fault.
Okay.
It's not even the scholar's fault. If he's a sincere, legitimate scholar, and he makes a mistake, he gets a reward for that. If he gets it right, he gets even more reward for that. Scholars are human, they're going to make mistakes.
Yeah. But you still disagree with the logic?
All I say is, for me, I think that the opinion that I follow makes more sense.
Okay. So what's our side? I mean, our side's bottom line, where we kind of draw the line and say our side is right.
Unless it's specifically forbidden, it's allowed. Forbidden alcohol, running blood, pork. There's a couple of examples specifically forbidden. Other than that, you should say Bismillah, say God's name before eating it.
So for me, it's that verse in Surah Maida where it says the food of the Christians and the Jews is permitted for you, given that they follow the guidelines. And we know what their guidelines are, right? How do we know? According to Ibn Arabi, who was a scholar from the 15th century, he said, you'll know by asking their scholars. So what their scholars say, that's considered permissible in their, and if it's considered permissible for them, then it's permissible for us. So
honestly, because like if you're going by what you're saying, you can eat any meat in the world. It doesn't have to be Christian or Jewish meat, right?
If you say God's name before eating it.
Right. So that's your opinion then.
Based off of what I've read, I would say that.
Are there any like traditional scholars that have that opinion?
I'm not as well versed on it.
Traditional scholars, I don't think so, just because they didn't... I don't know of any scholars that lived in Muslim minority countries.
But let me ask you this,
Anwar. They usually emigrated.
Is your opinion that there should be traditional scholars that justify it in order to follow that opinion?
Well, say it again. I'm sorry.
Because you're asking, are there any traditional scholars that support it? Is your opinion that there needs to be a traditional scholar that has that opinion in order to follow it?
I think that their opinion is going to be more valid than my opinion.
Okay, so let me give you the example that I was going to give you earlier. So there is another example which we've had a discussion on, maybe a future podcast topic, the whole idea of interest in if it's haram or not, where there are hundreds of years of scholarly opinion. To this day, I don't even know if there's any scholar out there that says that interest is okay, but I think that we're in the same boat, that interest is not haram. In that case, you think it's okay to go against that scholarly opinion hundreds of years. I don't even know if there's any scholar today that agrees with our opinion, but it's okay in that case. But not necessarily in a...
Well, tell me this. When did the modern banking system start?
I mean, I think banking, as far as borrowing...
The modern banking system as it stands
today... But the basis that it's off of...
No, not the basis. Interest, my opinion,
at its root is you borrow something, and when you return it, you're paying more than what you took.
Yeah, that's
right?
Interest.
Right.
That's interest, but is that riba? Like...
Right. Well, I mean, that's...
My thing is not that they're not understanding Islam... This, like, we're talking about a totally spiritual issue when we talk about Zabiha. When you're talking about economics, you're talking about a financial thing, right? So you need economists. You need people who really understand interest and riba, and they need to understand completely the religion, and they also need to understand completely the financial system. And my opinion is that I don't think that, first of all, traditional scholars from 1,000 years ago, their opinion no longer applies. Because it's a different banking system now than existed then.
I mean, it's much more complex today, but at the very root of it, at a basic level, banking, investment, giving someone money. I give you 1,000 today, tomorrow you give me back 1,200. I give you 5 cows today, tomorrow you give me back 7 cows. That's a basic concept that, you know, it's there today. It was there hundreds of years ago, thousands of years ago. It was there in the days of the prophet, borrowing cattle.
I will not concede that the modern banking system mirrors exactly the banking system of 1,000 years ago.
Time value of money, borrowing and returning back more than you borrowed, that's been around forever.
I'm sure that may have been around forever, but we're talking about an entire global system based completely on interest.
Let me interject. Okay, so the major distinction between the banking system, classical banking system and today, is the concept of securitizing non-currency. So do you recall anything like that in the history of finance and economics, where non-currency is used as security?
Cattle, animals, sheep.
And then the value of that security increases.
Yeah, I think there's a specific example in the prophets there of him borrowing cattle, and then when he returned it here, he returned more cattle than what he borrowed. I mean, that sort of stuff has been around forever. Yeah.
I don't understand economics well enough either. That's part of the problem. But I don't think that Islamic scholars do. That's my point. I think I cannot concede that, like, today's modern... what was the national debt of the average empire, you know, or whatever, 1,000 years ago?
I have no idea.
Probably no debt.
No, that's not true. No,
they all had debt. They all had trillions,
almost,
the equivalent of trillions of debt.
Not,
and they were all paying interest on that to whom?
Yes, always.
I mean, there were always,
like,
mercenaries
always.
And hired soldiers and... I mean, there's things that people...
Let's just put it this way. In Game of Thrones terms, there's always been an Iron Bank of Braavos that does the exact same thing, where if they feel that some entity is not able to pay them back, they'll support another one to overthrow them that agrees to take on the debt that was originally owed.
Maybe. But the thing that was happening at the time that was riba, I think, is different from what we call interest now.
Yeah,
the thing that was called riba is now called loan sharking.
Is now called usury.
It was aggressive lending. It was like detrimental to society.
No, we agree on that. That's not my point. We agree on
I
that.
I think the scholars don't understand that. That's my
my point.
So
scholars not understanding.
Yeah, but the thing is, nothing has changed about Zabiha.
And so that was going to be my question. So it's not just about Zabiha, but it's about the contractual relationship between our non-Muslim figures of authority and us as a minority. Do we accept their rules as applicable and kind of follow the general guidelines of our rules? I say we do.
We accept their laws.
No. I mean, even like their spiritual laws that are in line with ours that we're given leeway to accept. In this case, Surah Maida says their food is okay for you. So is it okay? What they consider okay for themselves in the spiritual realm and in the legal realm, is it okay for us? I argue that it is, based on the scholarly opinion that I follow. And because we live in this country as a minority, we don't get it our way. But is their way illegal for us?
I feel
I
by looking
no.
at the that surah and Christians and Jews, we're looking at one of the points. I think the big point is saying Bismillah before eating it makes it okay. And then to help further clarify that, the Quran says even the
because
the
that's,
Jews and
because
the Christians,
that's exactly what
just
Christians
to make it clear
do.
It doesn't have to be Muslim, even if it's Christians and Jews, it's okay as
or
well
Hindus
to help make it perfectly clear.
So that's essentially what Christians do when they bless the food. That's their way of saying Bismillah,
right?
So according to Qaradawi and Ibn Arabi, if they do it and it's okay for them, as long as it doesn't violate what we do or our core beliefs of Islamic dietary restrictions, then it's permissible, according to them. So do you still disagree
I'm
with
still
that?
I'm still going to use a bia when I leave here.
No, I mean, no, that's fine.
You are, but for the sake of discussion.
For the sake of discussion,
yeah.
We're not going to change anyone's opinion.
I recognize that
anyone in this room.
I recognize that you consider that the more valid opinion.
Okay.
That's all I can say.
Did we?
But I do not consider it the more valid opinion, and I won't.
Okay. So if God himself...
I think there's too much of a gray area. When the Quran specifically says, don't call it haram unless you know for sure it's haram, and I clearly tell you it's haram, then I think that should be, like, you know, what you're going off of. If there's a gray area, which I agree there's different schools of thoughts, but there's a gray area there, I would hesitate towards calling it haram.
So let me ask you, if Qaradawi himself was here telling you this, you would still disagree with him?
I mean, I can't see. How am I going to argue with a scholar, you know what I mean? But I'm going to ask him, do you know about Abu Hanifa? Do you know about other scholars who have different opinions to them? I mean...
And if he answers, I mean...
Well, obviously, there are scholars alive who did today.
I think he does know about them. Yeah.
No, but I'm saying, like, he would tell me that their opinion is also legitimate. And if he told me their opinion is illegitimate, then I would tell him, you're not a good scholar.
No, I'm asking, oh, of course. But I'm asking if he put a Big Mac in front of you and said, you know, given all my authority in this field, nothing will happen to you if you eat this. Allah will not punish you. You will not, you're not going against your faith. In his capacity, as like the leader of Azhar. And...
Well, maybe if it was a double cheeseburger.
All right, that about wraps it up. Have we covered everything we wanted to cover?
I think so.
Anik?
I think so. I don't think anyone in this room is going to change their opinion.
And that's okay. I mean, that's one of the wonderful things that is that there are differences of opinion.
We teach the controversy.
Yeah. So you heard it. This is the most controversial issue of our time. Families don't talk to each other because
wars are being fought.
Sounds good. All right, guys. Next time, more calls, please.
More calls, please.